Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Voted in favor of a resolution supporting a continued U.S. presence in Iraq, with 3 Republicans dissenting and 42 Democrats voting yes for the measure. In Iraq, this week's massive security operation in Baghdad, including a 4-hour driving ban during prayers today, failed to stop a shoe bomber from blowing himself up and killing at least 10 other people at an important Shiite mosque. Just yesterday, the Iraqi National Security Advisor proclaimed the beginning of the end of al-Qaeda in Iraq, following the death of its leader Abu Musab al-Zarqawi last week. But what exactly is the security situation in Iraq? Michael O'Hanlon, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, has compiled the latest statistics. They're out today. He joins us from a Brookings studio in Washington. Welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
Well, as you know, President Bush said this week that progress can be measured in terms such as how much electricity Iraqis are now receiving, how much Iraqi oil is being sold. You've compiled all of that. So overall, what's your headline?
The headline is that we agree with the president here, but we don't think that we are winning now. And while I had been hopeful for the first couple of years that the overall trajectory was at least slightly upward in the right direction, I think that the overall conclusion of the last couple of years, especially as punctuated with the last 6 months, is that we are more or less treading water. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the killing of Zarqawi and the formation of the new Iraqi government gives some recent grounds for hope, but we haven't yet seen any progress on the ground associated with that. And so I think that's going to have to remain in the realm of right. hypothetical as opposed to proven.
So you agree with the president that it can be measured, but you're saying that it's, as it's measured now, things don't look so good. Well, let's break it down. I'm looking at a graph, by the way, that's printed in today's Boston Globe. If progress is measured in Iraqi services, the stuff of daily life, the news actually looks okay. I'm looking at more electricity compared to last month.
Yes, it's true that the utilities in Iraq they're not doing great, but they are essentially struggling to more or less hover around Saddam Hussein levels. In some cases, they're a little worse. In the case of telephones, for example, they're much better. But the overall story is that utility performance is at or maybe on average slightly below Saddam levels. It's not a disaster, and Iraq certainly is not and has never been, or at least not for many years, one of the world's poorest countries. Life is generally not destitute for most people most of the time, but we are also not seeing a growing economy and not really seeing progress since the initial recovery from the invasion in those first months after Saddam's fall.
You are seeing things like, more telephone subscribers, many more, 7.5 million as opposed to 0.8 million pre-war. But still, there are other things to look at, such as the number of trained Iraqi police officers and soldiers. Now, that number does seem to be way up.
Yes. In security terms, let me just say the telephone point that you make is correct, and it is the overwhelmingly most positive statistic on the economic side. The only one that might rival it is independent media, as you might suspect. In the security sphere, the overall message is things are not getting better, except the Iraqi security forces are becoming better trained, so that there is the hope that over time we can hand off more and more of this war responsibility to them. But the actual conditions on the ground, week by week, month by month, are not improving so far.
Daily attacks by insurgents, 90 in May, as opposed to 70 May of last year. Monthly incidents of sectarian violence, that's a huge jump, 250 in May of this year, as opposed to 20 May of last year.
Yeah, the worst single bit of news that's new this year, and people recall the February 22nd bombing of the Golden Mosque in Samarra, and that really punctuated the process, but it's continued, is inter-ethnic strife. We did not see a lot of that in the first 3 years. We see a great deal of it now, and that also, therefore, unfortunately, creates a downside to the training of Iraqi security forces, because most of them are primarily one ethnic group or another. So we're not only helping them get better at the jobs they should do of stopping crime and stopping the insurgency, we're unfortunately giving them the hypothetical capability to fight each other in a civil war should our departure be too abrupt or should things get out of hand.
Well, today the Iraqi deputy prime minister said that his government will soon announce that Iraqi forces are going to take over security from foreign forces in southern Iraq. And U.S. military officials also have a plan for what's called phased withdrawal. The big debate in Congress seems to be more about the timetable, whether or not there should be a timetable for that. What do you think, Michael O'Hanlon? How do these statistics about violence affect that debate over withdrawing U.S. troops?
Well, I think personally that the main issue should not be so much the pace of our reduction as whether the natural endpoint is zero or something more in the low tens of thousands. I think zero anytime soon is going to be a prescription for the distinct possibility of civil war, and it would be imprudent on our part unless the Iraqis insisted upon it. By contrast, I think going down to a much smaller U.S. presence that really is a backup role and laying out that vision now as we try to move towards it in the next couple of years, I think that would be smart and that should be doable.
And how much of Iraq does the U.S. and its allies really control, in other words, have control over?
Well, that's a tough question because you could say in one sense virtually all of it. There's no place where the insurgents control territory day in and day out in a blatant way. On the other hand, there's only about half the country that is anything close to a reasonably stable environment. And so the insurgents have enough presence and enough capability that they are causing violence and conducting attacks in about half the country on a very regular basis and turning that half of Iraq into by far the most violent part of the broader Middle East.
Michael O'Hanlon, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington with the latest statistics on security in Iraq. Michael, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
On this Father's Day weekend, we thought we'd take a moment with one family story. Molly O'Neill is the longtime New York Times Magazine food columnist, cookbook author, and public television host. She's told many a tale about food, but in her new book, she tells the story of her life with food relegated to a supporting role. Molly grew up in Columbus, Ohio, which was, by the way, the test kitchen for many of the country's food companies. She had five brothers. The youngest, Paul, would grow up to be that Paul O'Neill, the Jimmy Stewart-like star player for the Cincinnati Reds and the New York Yankees. If Molly's interest in food came from her mother, who'd had a privileged, if tragic, background, Paul inherited his love of baseball from their father, who dreamed larger than his means and whose love of baseball verged on religious fervor.
My father once told me that hitting a baseball perfectly sends a vibration through the entire body, a quivering that seems to match that of the ball as it spins through the sky. For an instant, the entire world shares that same roaring pulse. The distinction between the past, the present, and the future are revealed as false. And there is no doubt in anyone's mind that there is a God. Few batters experience a perfect hit. Those who do continue to play, often through humiliation and frequently through constant and excruciating physical pain, in order to once again experience that ringing of the marrow, that ecstatic sense of divine order.
That's Molly O'Neill reading from her book, Mostly True, A Memoir of Family, Food, and Baseball. And she joins us now in the studio with more. Welcome.
Thank you.
Quite a memoir. Is it true?
It is mostly true.
Well, did your parents, for instance, meet at a factory fire?
Oh, absolutely. The book took its name from something that I realized in the last month of my father's life. I got to spend the last month of his life with my father. And my father was a great storyteller, and from a young age, I always thought, what's he talking about? This can't be true. And during that last month, my great reckoning was to realize that he had the little creative flourish here and the little detail wrong over there. But in fact, everything that he told me about who I was and who he was and who our family was and what the world was about was mostly true.
You know, and that's what the book is about. And it's funny, I knew it was coming, the book. I was very much looking forward to it, a fan of both your writing and your brother's playing. So I thought the book would be some recipes and maybe some baseball stats, you know, the combination of the two. But it is quite revealing. It's a look at how a couple, your parents, in the 1950s, it seems we're trying to forge ahead with all the energy of that time while not looking back.
Right. My parents grew up in two different Americas, and so I grew up in the middle of a conversation about two different Americas. My mother's America had higher education, good silver, and a positive cash flow. And my father's America had a dairy herd, a dust bowl, and many generations of baseball playing. I was constantly pulled between the values of either parent.
Well, your mother also had alcoholism, suicide on her side of the family. She was sent to live with her wealthy uncle because her mom was mentally ill.
Right.
She would simply disappear and leave your mom and her siblings as kids to eat dry cake mix. So it's no wonder that your mom, when she gets to be mom, is so fastidious about food.
Right. My mother is fastidious about everything. She really had the idea that if you could control your world, you could control your life. She was a typical child of an alcoholic. Mm-hmm. And it really worked well with me. I was the firstborn, and I was a pretty docile, easy kid. And then, bang, 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 here come my brothers, like this litter of, you know, Jack Russell Terriers. And they were uncontrollable. And it was just like my mother's Waterloo. The level of chaos in any large family is huge, and she wasn't prepared for that.
Well, I wanted to say, too, that her attempts to, some would say control, some would say, you know, her fear that you might go the wrong way regarding
right.
food, are both funny but also tough to read. For instance, I'm thinking of the time where she goes out to get ice cream. Ice cream, you know, a big factor in the family life. But she has a hot fudge sundae, and she kind of tells you that because of the cash flow and the calories, you should have sherbet.
Right.
And you're a little kid.
Right. But, you know, in my earliest years, I never questioned my mother's decisions. But eventually, all of us rebelled, and we used to secretly make junk food. And that's how I learned how to control my brothers. We weren't allowed to eat junk food. And so when my parents went out for the evening, at a time when other kids were smoking cigarettes or buying illegal fireworks or making prank phone calls, we were making junk food dinners, like fake little pizzas. Or
a lot of Velveeta cheese.
Yeah, you know, making macaroni and cheese. My parents didn't believe in mixing food together.
You had meat, you had potato, you had vegetables, salad, dessert. Nothing was overcooked.
It was humiliating.
That's true.
And it was not only an embarrassment to us personally, it was an affront to Columbus, Ohio. Columbus, Ohio was the test market capital for food products of the United States. It can anoint the next Frito and the next president. And my brothers and I desperately wanted to be a part of that. We wanted to eat like everybody else.
Well, obviously, you overcame that. But I want to mention your father briefly because he also had this interesting background that, as you said, you delved into. He had fits as a child. He clung to the family myth that you were all deeply Irish when, in fact, he was half Czechoslovakian. Never mind that. And do I understand that, you know, he just didn't have a grasp of money and, in fact, blew your college tuition at one point.
It wasn't really. The IRS cleaned out all of his accounts because he forgot to pay his taxes for 15 years or something.
That.
Yeah, the pesky IRS. Yeah.
But he sounds so lovable.
Well, my father is the most lovable man in the world. And he had a huge heart, and he was a great dreamer. He was a grand mal epileptic as a child, and he grew up to pitch minor league baseball and to be a paratrooper. I mean, this was a man of just unfathomable kind of grit.
And he passed the love of baseball onto all the boys, your brothers, in part as a way to keep them, you know, from being arrested. They were wild.
Right. My brothers were wild as March hares, and my father realized that he had to find some way to channel that energy.
That's Molly O'Neill, author of Mostly True, a memoir of family food and baseball. And when we come back, how the broken dreams of her parents played out in the lives of Molly and her brother, former Yankee Paul O'Neill. Much more coming up here and now. Book Mostly True, a memoir of family, food, and baseball. And Molly, we were talking about your father, who became a Little League coach so that he could harness his five rambunctious sons, maybe fulfill some of his own unrealized baseball dreams. But we want to add, he was a tough coach, but he wasn't the abusive Little League dad that we hear about today.
No, my father never, ever would have gone along with the way Little League is done today. My father was a very tough coach, and he really believed in athleticism. Mm. But he also believed that the greatest motivator is fun. My brothers had a blast playing.
And yet, what's interesting to me when I read that, Paul O'Neill, your brother who made it to the majors in a big way, he never looked to me like he was having fun.
He wasn't. It was really hard for him. Not playing the game, but he's a very shy, private person, and being in the public eye was terribly painful. And also, the O'Neills of Columbus we believe that we are only as good as our last accomplishment. If Paul had 3 home runs and then struck out in his 4th at bat, he felt that the world had ended and he'd let down his team. Mm-hmm. He was very, very hard on himself.
And you both were. You write, at one point, he, like you, and at that time a hugely successful writer, you both struggle with feelings of being imposters.
Right. Because perhaps to a certain extent we were. My youngest brother really lived the life that my father had not gotten a chance to live. My father had been a minor league pitcher who had a paratrooping accident that ended his career. Plan B for him was enough sons for an infield. And my youngest brother made it all the way. It was a huge gift that he gave my father. It was really hard for him to do. It was a struggle every single day. Did he love it? Yes, he loved it. But he did it for my father.
Did you do the cooking for your mother?
Well, I never thought of it consciously, but as I was doing this book, I realized that, in fact, I expressed a life that she hadn't lived. She loves New York. She loves great restaurants. She loves people who dress beautifully. When she comes to visit me, she's enchanted with my life. Yeah. You know, the funny thing is that temperamentally, I'm probably more like my father, and my youngest brother is probably more like my mother.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about how you got to where you are, because as you said, you know, you took a side road off to junk food, but then you were a cook in a restaurant out on the Cape. You traveled and studied in France. When did you know, like, this is coming up inside me, this is the thing I want to be?
I never really knew it. I mean, I had cooked because I cooked at home and I knew the power of food. I thought I was going to be a poet and a painter, and then there was this rude intrusion of having to make a living.
That.
And I knew how to cook, and when I cooked, I could also write and I could also paint. And so it seemed to me, if cooking allows me to still do the writing and the painting, then cooking is what I should do. So I went to Provincetown to see if I had kind of the right stuff to cook in a large restaurant. And I worked at Ciro and Sal's with, you know, these 4 huge men in a very rough kitchen making 500 meals a night. And then I realized that I did have the grit to do that, and now I needed to get good at it. And at that point, I went to Paris and went to cooking school.
It's interesting because a lot of women are probably listening right now saying, well, wait a minute. You had the mother who sort of, you know, could eat hot fudge sundaes but warned you that perhaps not. So one would think you'd have a really screwed up, can I say, relationship with food. And in fact, there was a point where didn't you have to go to Weight Watchers?
When I was 16 or 15, I decided that I had to go to Weight Watchers because I didn't have any kneecaps. My brothers had these knobby kneecaps, and they would torture me. Where are your kneecaps? Calling all kneecaps. We're calling the Bureau of Missing Kneecaps. Where are your kneecaps? And so I went to Weight Watchers, and it was my good fortune that my group leader was cooking her way through Julia Child, changing the recipes to be consistent with a Weight Watcher diet. So I did that with her. From the time I was 15 until I was 16, I cooked all the way through Julia Child. I also became alarmingly thin during that time. And food has always been a really powerful thing to me. And when I worked in kitchens, I never worried about weight because you work so hard that what you worry about is keeping weight on.
Right. You're sweating back there.
Yeah. Then when I left that hard physical work and started working as a writer, I suddenly had to worry about what I ate again.
Yeah. One of the things that is lovely in the book is your relationship with your brothers, all of them, but also your youngest, Paul. And I just wanted to share, I have had a chance to sit behind the dugout here in Boston's Fenway Park, where, of course, the Yankees were the visiting team, and you know how that goes,
right,
at Fenway Park. And everybody's yelling at Paul O'Neill, you know, when he's going out, you know, he doesn't turn. And one day I yelled out, Paul, I love your sister's writing. And he turned and he came over to me, like his face lit up. He was like, oh, my sister. I want to talk about my sister. How, you know, the book seems also to be about siblings helping each other survive, not just childhood, but stardom.
I think that we've had a lot to deal with. you know, Paul is just such a superstar, and in my little world, I've done well. And I think that we really had to deal with the difference between being human beings and human doings. Paul's last game at Yankee Stadium, when the fans were going wild, when my brothers and I all jumped to our feet to cheer him, we were finally just like everybody else. And to me, that was the ending of this book, that it took us until midlife to achieve the things we felt we needed to achieve to please our parents and as homage to our parents and for our family name and for our family destiny. And when it was finally over, we were left with, well then, who are we?
And what do you want to have to eat?
What's for dinner?
Molly O'Neill, her book is Mostly True, a memoir of family, food, and baseball. Thanks so much for talking to us about it.
Thank you.
And next week on Here and Now, American companies replace full-time employees with part-time online tinkerers. It's the next phase of outsourcing. It's called crowdsourcing. Also, Black Hawk Down author Mark Bowden on the continuing turmoil in Somalia. That's all next week. Stay with us. Much more ahead Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the
crazy around June 9th and will stay that way for a month. It's World Cup soccer season, and 32 national teams from six continents are battling it out in Germany for the title of World Soccer Champion. The U.S. faces a must-win match tomorrow against Italy, a team that Americans have never defeated in five tries. And as we all know, soccer, football to the rest of the world, has been relatively slow to catch on here in the States, which is weird because we're a democracy. You're about to hear why that matters from Franklin Foer. He's editor of The New Republic and author of How Soccer Explains the World, an Unlikely Theory of Globalization. And Frank, first of all, you're a huge soccer fan, and you say what you love about the World Cup is how the little guy can come shining through. So can you first share one of your favorite stories from this year's Cup?
Mighty Sweden played Trinidad and Tobago, which is the smallest country to ever qualify for the World Cup. And nobody really gave Trinidad a chance in this game. Strategy would have dictated that you just put everybody in front of the goal and try to prevent Sweden from scoring. But instead, he sent his men on the attack, and he stuck on extra attackers on the field. And so this like small, beleaguered Trinidad team playing against all these great European stars for Sweden just started going crazy, attacking goal. And it may not sound like a tremendous result because it ended in a 0-0 tie, which I'm sure for most of a lot of Americans would be the epitome of a boring game. But it was really fun and really exciting, and it was really great to see a tie for Trinidad, which was essentially a win for them because they're so small and expected to get next to nothing.
But Frank, that's the thing. That's the thing that Americans, many Americans, have a problem with, which is there's no scoring. I mean, to them, it's like a widescreen and a bunch of ants running around. Now, you've just explained that there was real strategy there, but you know that there aren't a lot of goals is one of the tough things for you know, many Americans. Well, you know, we all know that it's about so much more than the sport. There's ethnic and religious rivalries. We've talked here about how, for the English, soccer is still all about World War II. But you also write about how, you know, there's a certain kind of government that forges a winning team, and a communist country, for instance, never won the World Cup.
I definitely discovered that communist countries, while racking up a winning record against capitalist countries, generally tended to falter at later stages in the tournament, and no communist country ever won a World Cup.
Well, you point out that it's because there's a certain rigidity that might have produced a great gymnast in Soviet countries, but
exactly.
Didn't produce, you know, people who could play with individual flashes of brilliance.
Yes. Soccer is a collectivist game, and that collective spirit gets you a long way, but to really, really succeed in it, you need these flashes of creativity, of great individual genius.
That brings us to mind Dave Eggers' very funny column that he's written on soccer, in which when he was in high school and wanted to play it, his coach told him that soccer was a commie game because you didn't use your hands, and sports where one's hands were not used were commie sports.
Right, exactly. Well, sadly, that is not just particular to Dave Eggers' coach. Jack Kemp, congressman from Buffalo, former quarterback, Republican presidential candidate, once took to the floor of the U.S. House of Representatives and actually denounced soccer as socialist and un-American.
Well, I want to go through some of your other findings, because, for instance, you found that fascist countries used to do well in soccer because, after all, who wants to disappoint a leader who might break your leg? And more important, no country has ever won a World Cup while committing genocide.
That's right. I mean, you had a fantastic Yugoslavia team in the 1990 World Cup. You had pretty solid German teams in the 1930s, and none of them performed as well as they should have. And my theory was that mental energy that should have been devoted to beating Italian and Argentines on the soccer field was maybe channeled into thoughts about murdering Jews and Muslims.
Well, there you go. But you do come to the conclusion that the country that produces the most winning soccer, World Cup soccer teams, the countries are democracies.
Social democracies, mm-hmm. in particular. These are the countries that have are very industrialized, that have large urban working classes, but also have some sort of sense of social solidarity, countries with pretty extensive welfare states. And what I found was that these social democracies did better than the bad fascist teams or the bad communist teams or the bad military junta teams.
There you go. And that's possibly why we're noticing that here in the U.S., the Democratic Party is actually maybe thinking those countries are onto something. The Democratic Party, at least one Democratic Party group, is running ads during the soccer games. Do you think that the Democrats perhaps are looking to soccer to be the answer to the, you know, NASCAR Republicans?
God help them if they are. John Kerry was a soccer player. He played on the left wing for St. Paul's school. And this was a fact that he, I think, wisely suppressed during the campaign. There were no shots of him passing a ball around on a airport tarmac, because I think he understands that there still is widespread hostility to the game. And I think that if Democrats embrace soccer, it may help turn off a lot of those NASCAR voters who precisely consider soccer to be iffy, un-American, communist, possibly homosexual, definitely girly.
You explain in your book that this is because many in the U.S. equate soccer with globalization, and they don't like either.
Well, they may not consciously equate it with globalization, but I think that's the subtext to a lot of the anti-soccer sentiment in this country. I tried to examine exactly where these soccer haters were coming from, and what I found was that a large portion of them were fans of baseball. And baseball is obviously a sport that's very much part of the national self-image, grandma, apple pie, et cetera. It's a national pastime. And if you look at soccer's rise in this country, it really has come at baseball's expense, that kids who used to play Little League Baseball now play soccer. So I think that a lot of the anxiety that comes through in this anti-soccer hatred is essentially an anxiety about this particular form of globalization, about losing this custom, this culture, this tradition of baseball, which is so central to the way that a lot of Americans distinguish themselves.
And it's something we made up. We like the stuff we made up better.
Yes.
Franklin Foer, by the way, related to Jonathan Safran Foer, the author?
He's my brother.
There you go. Editor of The New Republican, author of How Soccer Explains the World, An Unlikely Theory of Globalization. Frank, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And we're gathered here for the game of your life.
Lovely.
I want to see you put your flags up in the air right now.
Well, there's bad news for Frank's favorite underdog team. England beat the Trinidad and Tobago Warriors 2-0 yesterday, scoring both goals in the final minutes of the game. But there's still hope for the World Cup's pluckiest team. They play Paraguay on Tuesday. Go Warriors. And still to come, download this. Pop culture guru Renee Graham plugs in her iPod for us. You're listening to Here and Now.
We will defend. We will jump and shot them to the very end.
Well, it's time to open up the Here Now mailbag and hear some of your thoughts. And we heard from many of you after we spoke with Michael Berg about the news that militant Abu Musab al-Zarqawi had been killed by U.S. bombs. It's believed that Zarqawi beheaded Michael's son, Nick Berg, in 2004. And Michael Berg told us that despite that, he did not want Zarqawi killed because it would just spark another cycle of revenge. Well, Bill Commons of Abington, Pennsylvania writes, many will likely disagree with Michael's rejection of the idea that a death can ever be avenged by further killing. However, there are many of us who hold this view. His unwavering conviction, even after his family's misfortune, should inspire us all to reflect. Erica Friedel of Winston-Salem, North Carolina, added, this was truly one of the most powerful interviews I've ever heard. I found myself weeping in my car during lunch break. And Gregory Maguire, who wrote the book Wicked but happens to be a listener, wrote, Mr. Berg, quoting John Donne, said, every man's death diminishes me. Well, Mr. Berg's moral courage enlarges me. We also spoke recently with Sandy Tolan, author of The Lemon Tree, the story of a Palestinian, Bashir, who fled his home during the Arab-Israeli War of 1948, and Dahlia, the Jewish girl who later moved into that same house with her parents, who'd survived the Holocaust. Marilyn Bentoff had a personal reaction to the story, which she knew something about. She knew that Dahlia, the Jewish woman, later converted the house to a place where Palestinians and Jews could come together, a place called Open House. But Marilyn did not know that Bashir, the Palestinian, was charged with being behind one of the first bombings in the Intifada. We asked Marilyn to read us her letter.
Your feature was a surprise and a shock. Your story sent me back 37 years to the 1969 bombing of the Supersol Market in Jerusalem. I was living across the street when it happened. What I didn't know until today was that Bashir was involved in the bombing. You see, a few years ago, a group of young Israelis and Palestinians came to this country to talk about Open House. They were inspiring. As a Jew and a Zionist, I've been both furious and heartbroken about the treatment of the Palestinians. I felt I could even understand, if not accept, Palestinians who felt the need to use violence. But when I heard about Bashir's involvement in the Supersol explosion, I remembered the blood and the body parts, the shattered glass. Had it not been for the late arrival of a remarkable Moroccan woman, Esther Cohen, I might have been among the bloodied and dismembered. That 40-year-old woman who came once a week to help me, she was a mother of 11 children, a refugee from Arab violence in Morocco. Esther, always dancing with happiness for the smallest comfort that came her way, whose youngest daughter succeeded in getting to graduate school in California. Had Esther been 15 minutes late that day, we would both have gone to the Supersol and perhaps not returned. So, today I'm a little more hard in my feelings. If I condemn, and I do, the State of Israel's acts, bulldozing houses, I also condemn Bashir. I understand but cannot condone these actions or call them legitimate resistance. What I learned on your show hit me over the head with the reality that nearly killed me. When I lived in Israel, I knew Palestinians who called Israelis cousin and vice versa. Their best hope will be realized by people on both sides, both so in love with the land that they must learn to share the patrimony of their common ancestor. Like Dahlia and Bashir, they have a deep and powerful connection that is stronger than they are.
Marilyn, thank you.
Well, when the program was over, I kept thinking, my God, Bashir! And then I thought, I bet they have no idea when they go on the air how they can affect people. I've got to let them know.
So, send us your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org, or you can give us a call and leave a message, 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your name, phone number, and town. Stay with us. More ahead, Here and Now.
Mm-hmm.
are they listening to? You see them crossing the streets with a lilt in their step, bobbing heads on the subway to a sound only they can hear. Telltale white wires leading from iPod to earbuds. What are they listening to? Well, here's another chance to tap in with a Here and Now contributor. Today, we intercept the signal from our pop culture critic, Renee Graham. Renee, what are we listening to?
That's Gnarls Barkley. They are an R&B hip-hop duo. People probably know them well. The two members, CeeLo, who used to be with Goody Mob, and DJ Danger Mouse, who came to some acclaim a few years ago, although he got in trouble for putting out the Grey album, which was mixing the Beatles' White album with Jay-Z's Black album.
Oh, I do remember that.
Exactly.
Is this considered typical hip-hop? Because it doesn't sound it.
It's not. I mean, because it's much more R&B, even though CeeLo and Danger Mouse come out of the hip-hop world. It's interesting. It's what CeeLo's always done is really sort of expand the notions of what black music can sound like. So what you have on Gnarls Barkley is lots of R&B, very vintage sort of 70s funk and R&B, but you also have something weird like a cover of the Violet Femmes' Gone Daddy Gone, which is just not something you're going to be accustomed to hearing on an R&B album.
Well, speaking of expanding, this is about expanding our, you know, listening, stretching our ears a little bit, and you also have some vintage calypso for us. This is excavated from the Smithsonian Folkways collection. What's this?
This is Lord Invader. It's a song called Crisis in Arkansas, and it's about what was happening in Little Rock, Arkansas in 1957. And it's Lord Invader sort of jousting with Governor Orville Faubus about not allowing black kids to go to Central High School.
If you ever stop to think that we all are human, you will be a humanitarian. Instead, you are encouraging segregation and do not believe in integration. But God made us all and in him we trust. Nobody in this world is better than us. One day you will be made to realize 6 feet apart make us all of one size. So take off that black bow tie, Leo, and that black tuxedo. You hate our guts yet you're wearing black. Please take off everything black off your back.
We understand it's from Calypso in New York. That's a new release from Folkways?
Yes, Smithsonian Folkways has been putting out this really good collection the last few years of Calypso from the 40s, 50s, and 60s. Wonderful collection.
And this is music that your ear really gravitates to, I understand. I mean, isn't your dad from the West Indies?
My dad was from St. Thomas, and my family has roots going back to Barbados, so I grew up listening to a lot of Calypso music, and Lord Flea, Lord Nelson, Lord Invader, everyone was about Lord, Mighty Sparrow. It's just wonderful music that I'm really glad is getting a chance to be heard again.
And when you were growing up, did the 1957 South in Arkansas, was that resonating in the West Indies?
I think it was to a degree, especially in certain areas. People traveled back and forth. People in the West Indies certainly had relatives here, and what was happening in Arkansas and other parts of the South in the 50s and 60s was reaching the world. Everyone knew what was going on, so I think it was very interesting that Lord Invader did this, but he also spent time in New York. So he was learning a lot more about right. What was happening in this country, the civil rights movement.
Well, what we love about you, Renee, is that you love what you know, and you spend a lot of time seeking out things you don't know, and then you come back and share them with us. And we understand that you're now hooked on Korean soundtrack music.
I'm a big, big fan of contemporary Korean cinema, and one of the best things about these films is that they have the most wonderful soundtracks. There's techno, there's classical music, there's rock references, a lot of Western influences. It's wonderful music. And we're going to hear a cut right now from my favorite Korean film, probably my favorite film overall, called Old Boy, which is a 2003 film by Park Chan-wook.
The song is called Cries and Whispers from Old Boy. This is terrific, and I understand there's a website where you can find more of this.
You can't go into Best Buy or Tower Records and find Korean film soundtracks. So where I tend to buy most of mine is a website called YesAsia.com, and they cater to all sorts of Asian culture. You can find films there and collectibles, and they have a huge selection of soundtracks, and that's where I get all my Korean film soundtracks. And I think we're going to hear another cut from another Korean film, from the film Bittersweet Life, and this is Bittersweet Life 3 from the film, which is directed by Kim Ji-woon. soundtracks here tend to be the latest songs or a collection of songs from the 60s and 70s. Korean film soundtracks are often all original music, and they sell really well in Korea.
There's a mix of sounds, classical music as well?
It's the variety, and that's, you know, it sets the mood, but it's not just snippets. The songs stand their own. They're fully composed pieces, and the soundtracks hold up even when you're not watching the movie. They're just great music.
Well, and speaking of variety, your iPod is packed. And by the way, this was a sort of a pop quiz on Renee. We called her and asked her what was on your iPod, and this is what was on your iPod, and it included Maria Callas.
I'm a huge Maria Callas fan, and most people wouldn't think I like opera, but I have probably about 17 or 18 of her arias on my iPod, and I wouldn't classify myself as a classical music fan or an opera fan, but I dig her voice. And we're going to listen to one of her arias from Lucia de Lammermoor.
This is Sparghi d'amore pianto,
which I believe means cry tears of love.
Renee Graham, fully immersed in the pop culture world, how did you stumble on her?
A good friend of mine is a drag queen performer, and he did a number called Cooking with Maria, and he did this cooking show while he was lip-syncing to Una Voce Poca Fa from Barbara of Seville. I think I really butchered the name of that.
That's all right.
And he did this lip-sync to it as he was pretending to do this cooking show. And I really liked it. So after that, I asked him what it was, and he told me. And I went to the record store and started buying some of her operas.
Okay, well, perhaps you've turned someone else on
the things you can learn from drag.
That's another lesson. But I was going to say the things you can learn from you, Renee Graham,
right.
Here now as pop culture critic. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Robin.
And by the way, we'll have details of the music you heard on her iPod at here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Have a wonderful Father's Day and join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and